CataractCoach.com podcast series, episode number 48, with Johnny Gayton, a pioneering ophthalmologist with incredible passion. Welcome back to our Cataract Coach podcast, and today I have a very special guest, someone who has been an idol to me for decades. I've learned so much from him, and I've loved following his amazing path in ophthalmology and in life, and that is Johnny Gayton. Johnny, welcome to our podcast.
Thanks so much, Uday. I'm really thrilled to be with you. You know, you have become as good a podcaster as you are a teacher and surgeon. So I just want to congratulate you. I've actually been listening to the podcast since you started it, and I absolutely love it.
Yeah, thank you, John. I really appreciate that. For me, it's just a fun conversation with a fellow surgeon, and we just kind of chat back and forth for about an hour. It always ends up being so interesting. Now, I love a lot of what you've innovated in ophthalmology. And so I've learned, like, I mean, piggyback IOLs. I just made a presentation of piggyback lenses. I'm like, that's just Johnny Gayton all over it. Tell me about all these things.
Well, you know, people have always said that I tend to think a little bit outside the box. And back in the 80s, I hate to admit that, I've actually been in ophthalmology for 44 years. But back in the 80s, I noticed that almost everyone that came in that it had cataract surgery in our area had significant against cerebral astigmatism. Mm-hmm. And I actually sat down one night and spread charts out all over my floor. And I was looking at patients that I had done and patients that other doctors had done. And I said, you know, the thing that's in common about these is that they have a cerebral cylinder that gets worse each year.
Right.
So I started thinking, you know, I believe it's that cataract incision from the top. Mm-hmm. And I think that them blinking over the years is stretching that wound and causing it to get cerebral cylinder. So out of the clear blue, I started operating temporally.
Right.
And that was actually when we were doing the non-foldable lenses. So it was a 6 millimeter wound. And you know what I found? They didn't drift. And so Right. then I presented doing routine cataract surgery from a temporal approach. And you would have thought I was speaking out against mom, the Pope, and apple pie. People called me to abandon it. They said it wasn't going to work. And then a few years later, I got an award for it. So
I was that's what they say. Yeah. Right? They say today's dogma is tomorrow's dog food. You got to be able to keep changing the times. But even recently, this week, I did a case where a patient, I did a scleral tunnel temporally for a large MSICS surgery.
Exactly. I mean, and it actually turned out to be, you know, a really phenomenal advance, as we found. And then when Mike McFarland came up with sutureless and Howard Fine came up with clear cornea, I mean, it just transformed our profession. And I was, you know, just thrilled to be a part of that. And then, interestingly enough, shortly after that, in the 80s, I had a patient came in with angle closure, and we did a PI, and the angle closure persisted. Mm-hmm. And we, you know, looked at it and thought, you know, the problem there is the lens. And I think, you know, that is an issue with people with narrow angle frequently is the lens. So I started talking about removing the lens for narrow angle. And as you know, that's wasn't received real well initially. That Bobby Osher told me one time when I was presenting, I was sharing the OCT and showing, you know, how the angle was narrowed and all. And he said, Johnny, what are you trying to pull? That lens is no bigger than any other lens. And you're telling me that lens is causing their angle. And we were in a big auditorium and you could have heard a pin drop. Mm-hmm. And I looked and I said, Bobby, in the land of giants, excuse me, at the land of midgets, I'm a giant. Okay.
You're right.
And what I was meaning, of course, I'm a short person, but in little, with little people, I've looked real tall. And in a normal eye, that lens wasn't a problem. But in an eye that had a small anterior segment, that
right.
lens was a problem. And that was causing narrow angle. And then, of course, lens removal has become quite popular for narrow angle now. And,
right know, now, it's probably the best way of fixing it. If you got a patient who's 60 plus with narrow angles and a little tiny hyperopic eye, short anterior segment, pseudophakia is the gift.
Yeah. And that's actually what led me then to the piggyback. Is in our area, we have a lot of, believe it or not, 17 to 20 millimeter eyes. And
so
we had a patient that came in and he was losing his job because he didn't have enough uncorrected vision. He was going to lose his job that he had worked at for about 20 years. And I thought, well, what can I do to give him decent uncorrected vision? Because he needed about 50 diopters of power.
Wow, yeah.
And all we could get at the time was 30. And so that was the first piggyback is when I did that. Interestingly enough, I don't know if you remember that particular case, but I put the first lens in. It was what a Plato convex lens. The first lens went in convex side down. The second lens, I put in the sulcus with the convex side anteriorly. And then I thought that would work better. Little did I know that it didn't matter.
Right.
But it turned out quite fortuitously, I did it the correct way with one in the bag and one in the sulcus. And then when we started doing them all in the bag, that's when the interlenticular opacification started.
Right.
And Joel Sugar actually is the person that discovered what was causing that, which was the anterior capsule being on the anterior optic 360 degrees, that the epithelial cells grew between the two lenses, much like grass growing through cracks in concrete.
Mm-hmm.
And that was what was causing the interlenticular opacity. So the key on doing a piggyback is to either have one in the bag and one in the sulcus, or if you're going to have both in the bag, have a large enough capsule rectus so that it doesn't cover 360 degrees of the anterior lens.
Now, if you have a patient today, all that you've learned over the decades about doing these tiny hyperopic eyes, and you have a huge experience, if you got a patient coming in today, let's say a short eye, 18, 19, 20 millimeter axial length, and let's say you calculate the lens power out to, like before, 50, and obviously our calculations today are better than they were 40 years ago, would you do now primary piggyback, or would you put in the max power lens you have now, let them heal up, see where the refraction is, and then go back later for us to piggyback?
So it really, in my experience, it depends on the patient's condition.
Okay.
And to be candid, I do a lot of charity work like you do.
Sure.
And sometimes, you know, they can only afford one procedure, or I'm only in a position of giving them one procedure. And a lot of these patients are the ones that, you know, have financial difficulties. So a lot of times I will go ahead and put both lenses in. If that somebody that can go through two procedures safely, then I think your idea of putting one in and waiting and then putting the second lens in. Or you may find that when you put the highest power in that you can get, they may do fine with just a little PRK over the top and you don't have to re-enter the eye.
Yeah. I think in the U.S., the highest power I've found readily available is you can get an Alcon Aquasoft monofocal and up to 40.0.
Correct. It looks like a marble.
it is quite thick.
Yeah,
that's actually a good warning. When you're using that lens, you've got to use the bigger cartridge. Don't try to push it through the tiny cartridge.
Exactly.
Go ahead and enlarge your incision a little bit. You're right.
These are not cases that you want to do an IOL exchange on because you damage the haptic or damage the lens. So exactly right. Use a larger cartridge and also at the same time, enlarge that wound a little bit.
Yeah, and the interesting part was like, obviously the cases that have a very tiny AC length, but actually a relatively normal AC depth, are the ones that calculate even more difficultly. That's the ones where you get like the eye well so much farther back or posterior in the eye that, I mean, gosh, I mean, the calculations are all over the place.
Yeah. In fact, one of the videos that I sent you today, the patient had a very, very shallow anterior chamber, but had a normal axial length. And, you know, that, you know, as Jack Holliday has taught us, you can have a small eye with a small anterior chamber. You can have a small eye with a normal anterior chamber. You can have a normal eye with a shallow anterior chamber. Right. So there's all of those combinations, and it can certainly throw us off.
Yeah, we'll definitely feature your videos that you sent me. Thank you. So this podcast is airing on a Sunday, and then this following Monday, Tuesday, we'll have these amazing videos you've sent, and I'll get those put up for our audience to watch. Now, in these tiny eyes, give us some pearls, because to be honest, my least favorite eyes to operate on are these really tiny eyes where you're so crowded in there, the AC depth is so shallow. Give us some pearls here. How do you approach these tough cases?
Yeah, for some reason, a lot of people in the Southeast have thought that those are my favorite eyes to work on.
So they send them to you.
So I get a lot of referrals for these. And I've developed some techniques that keep us from having to do a vitrectomy to get more space. So what I do is I make my primary and secondary incision, and I make them a little bit longer than I usually do just to make iris prolapse less likely. And then I irrigate in some intracameral lidocaine. It's very important to try to keep that chamber as deep as you can. So I go ahead and put viscoelastic in. And I noticed one of the points that you made one time, it's so important to push that back so that your capsulorhexis is a lot less likely to run radial. And sometimes your idea of doing a double capsulorhexis, that's a great idea. I try to handle it with just one, but if I'm concerned at all that it's going to run radial, I'll do exactly what you said and make a small one and then decompress the eye and then make a larger capsulorhexis. But one of the keys, I think, is be very judicious about hydrodissection. If you hydrodissect much, you're going to get iris prolapse. You know, one of the things that I don't even do any hydrodissection when I've got minimal room. And then, you know, just work slowly and be, you know, careful about doing debulking of the lens. And then I'll either chop or crack it and take it out. One of the hardest ones that I deal with, and I do this fairly often today, is a person that comes in with a 4+ or greater cataract, and they've got a slit open anterior chamber. And those are people that you just need to plan to take your time and just slowly work through it, debulking the lens and protecting the cornea.
Yeah, I booked those as the last one in my surgical lineup, last one of the day.
I agree wholeheartedly.
Yeah, though I love phaco chop, I agree with you. With these tiny eyes, I actually like to do a Gestapo chop, a groove down the middle. In fact, a double wide groove down the middle to really debulk it. And then when I crack it, each half is not 50-50 because I've debulked it. Each half is maybe 40-40. And then it's a lot easier to maneuver and sub-chop those halves then.
And sometimes I literally have to break it. Instead of, you know, breaking the lens into quadrants, I end up breaking it into 6 or 8 segments.
You're right.
You know, because the lens is just so large and the pupil won't dilate adequately. And then if you try to put in a Balgugan ring, that ends up holding the segments of the cataract posterior. They can be a nightmare, as you well know.
Those are tough. There's another thing with these tiny eyes that I once got burned on, and that is, surgery went beautiful. Patient came to my clinic wearing +10 glasses for distance, very hyperopic, small eye. Had a significant cataract, fixed it up, got him basically bang on plane, or maybe just a, you know, plane or a plus a half post-op. And I thought the patient would be thrilled to not have to be stuck in those +10 glasses. And the patient says to me, but everything looks so small now. because they were used to the plus 10 magnification, making everything look so big.
Yeah, in fact, it's amazing what people can really adapt to and end up enjoying. Interesting right. little side fact, I actually started with IntraCap and with aphakic spectacles. Wow. And so then I actually introduced IntraCap into our residency program. I went and took the McIntyre course, and then I ended up teaching the faculty IntraCap. And then when I got out of residency, I had to teach myself FACO. So right. it was an interesting transition. But you may know that IntraCap with aphakic spectacles used to be the most common cause of a broken hip. A whole lot right. of our patients would end up falling and breaking their hip with those. So the people that aren't used to them, they have a tough time. But the people that are used to them, they'll sometimes complain about the lack of magnification. Also, the highly myopic patients, they'll sometimes say, you know, I could hold something right here and I could read, and now I can't, you know.
Right.
So it's very important to go over with patients those type of things ahead of time, because if you've told them about it ahead of time, they regard you as a smart person. If you tell them about it after the fact, they'll say you caused their problem.
Yeah, you're guilty. Right. Yeah, I have a saying for the myopic patients. I said, you know that magic trick you have of taking off your glasses and reading up close? I said, that's going to disappear because you can't take off my surgery. Mm-hmm. They're like, oh, exactly. Okay.
And one thing that Sam Maskett told me long ago that I have held dear, and I've followed this adage, when a patient has a complaint or a problem, run to them rather than away from them.
Right.
Because our natural tendency is to recoil away and
right.
not want to deal with it. But if you show them their concern, because as Spencer Thornton used to regularly say, patients don't care how much you know till they know how much you care. Of if course. You show, you know, you're concerned, you're a lot less likely to get into medical legal trouble. And it's interesting, some of my patients that have had the most difficulties have been the patients that have referred me the most patients.
Right.
Just by showing them that I was concerned and doing everything I could to help their problem.
Right. They don't want to feel abandoned. If you tell them, I'll be by your side, whatever it takes to get through this complication, we're going to do it. Right. They feel a lot better. Oh, for sure. I think great points there. Now, Johnny, you've had an amazing, wild career out in ophthalmology, of course, but also your personal life. Like, people may not know, I'm a weightlifter like you. I love to lift weights, but you're beyond a weightlifter. You're like a literal record-holding power lifter, too.
Yeah, so I'm one of those unusual folks that when I take something on, I really go at it full steam ahead. In fact, J. Lawton Smith, many years ago, told me, Johnny, the way you could honor God the most is by doing things heartily. Do the best you could do. And that's what I tried to do with ophthalmology, and that's what I do with other things as well. And so when I started competing in weightlifting, I started really concentrating on the diet and workout routines and things of that nature. And I entered a contest on a whim and ended up leaving because I didn't think I'd done that well. And then on Monday, they show up at my office with medals that I'd won that I didn't even know I'd won. And then I go, well, interesting. I wonder how far I could take this. And so I entered the a local tournament, won it, entered the state championships, won it, entered the Mid-American championships, won it, became national champion, and then got to represent the United States in the world championships. And fortunately, I became a world champion. So it was
a
phenomenal experience. And then a crazy thing a day after that happened, these pro wrestlers came to see me and said, you know, we could present you as like Mighty Mouse. And with wrestling, people are looking for reasons to believe, like Santa Claus. And so if you do feats of strength in the ring, they'll believe. And me, I think through things. I thought about it for about 30 seconds and said, yes, I'll do
And then
it.
you and as usual, you go all in, you jump
Yeah.
in full force.
And it was a fun time, I have to say. There for a little while, I was actually better known in Georgia and in the U.S. as a wrestler than as an eye surgeon. So it was interesting, but it was a lot of fun.
Oh, it
And
sounds
now,
amazing.
what I'm doing now is I'm enjoying my 9 children and 16 grandchildren,
Oh,
and
man.
we're just having a grand time being a father and a poppy. Yeah.
Yeah, that's amazing. And you're also there, you're very close to the world's busiest airport in
That's
Atlanta.
very true.
And I see your posts from every corner of the world. You are doing an incredible amount of traveling too.
So I got, after I gave up competitive weightlifting, I got into points and miles.
Okay.
And Bobby Osher actually had me do a presentation at Tell It Like It Is on using points and miles. And that has been a phenomenal experience. In fact, I'm taking 3 of my grandchildren this summer on a round the world trip. And
Wow.
so I work hard still, and I play hard.
Yeah, that's wow. So points and miles. I never really got so into it, but I guess, yeah, you're right. You've got all these points and miles that you can use to actually fund the vacation or the trips for you.
Actually, I took 10 family members last year at this time to the Maldives,
Wow.
and I used points and miles to do it. In fact, my host there said she had never seen that happen before, and we had a fantastic time. And what I really want to do is I want to make memories for the children and the grandchildren so that
Right.
long after I'm gone, they'll remember Poppy with a smile on their face.
Oh, that's amazing. But now you still have a very busy practice there in Warner Robins.
I
So
do.
how do you balance all the traveling with all the with a busy practice?
Well, thankfully, I have people in with me now.
Oh,
And
good.
so I do, when I'm in town, I do clinic Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. And I operate all day Tuesday and Thursday. Still have a very busy surgical practice. In fact, I started yesterday at 6:45, and I finished about 6:45 yesterday evening, because I had several of those tough cases that we were talking about. And then when I have the opportunity to leave, they cover. And so it's a much better lifestyle than having to be here all the time. And one of the things that you may remember is, I used to be speaking a tremendous amount. And
Really?
then I ended up getting embezzled. And one of the things I would encourage your listeners is to pay attention to that. Someone told me one time there are two kinds of doctors, those that have been stolen from and those that are going to be. And
Yeah.
that was, Uday, that was devastating. I mean, I went from a position of being able to lecture a lot, being on the platform a lot, to all of a sudden being bankrupt. Because I'd been embezzled by trusted people. And that was a real tough time. I had to just really put my nose to the grindstone and work hard. And so I would encourage people to have real good financial folks looking at their numbers, because I've heard of this happening to a lot of people.
Yeah, it's pretty common among colleagues. It's surprisingly common
It
there.
really is. And it was hard to work through it, but thankfully my community supported me, and we were able to work through it. And now I have a good practice again, and I'm very thankful for that.
Oh, fantastic. Now, do you still fit in the other activities? Like, you still must lift weights from time to time?
Oh yeah, I still exercise. Not as crazy as I did it before, but
Right.
still exercise. And as you know, I travel, and And I absolutely love being with the grandchildren. That's just been what a joy.
Right. No, as in fact, when we talked to our cataract patients who are really up there in age, our nonagenarians, our 90-plus-year-old cataract patients, what do they always say? The most important things in life end up being family, friends, relationships, and experiences, i.e. travel. So I think you're doing all of it.
Yeah, it's so important to do that though, because I know I ended up, especially during that time when I was having to really work, the children didn't get to see me as much as I would have liked, and I'm trying to make up for that now. But you know what's also interesting is I look back, I'm 68 years old. I've been in ophthalmology for 44 years, opened my own practice when I was 27. And I'm kind of a bridge from
Right.
a lot of the people, the real pioneers. Like I was friends with Charles Kellman. He wrote the foreword to one of my books. And, McIntyre and Gimbel and, Spencer Thornton and all. And now, the people like you that have really advanced our profession, being able to see the transition from doing 3D cataract surgery with registration
Right.
now, whereas I started with the IntraCAP,
Right.
just seeing the change in our profession is phenomenal. I mean, I think we have the queen of specialties. I absolutely love it. And I wish I had longer to enjoy it, but I'm thrilled with today helping people see. It's a joy like none other to see people's faces light up because you've helped them see.
Right.
So I just love that about our profession. And I love seeing the progress that our profession has made. And I was sharing with somebody the other day, Matt, years ago when I used to learn new procedures, I had to learn them from a grainy videotape or go visit someone
Right.
or be at a meeting when someone was showing a video. And now we have HD videos that you share daily that we could learn all kind of procedures. I mean, I
Right.
just love that.
Yeah, I mean, you make a great point that the only constant in ophthalmology is change. It keeps changing
Exactly.
every year. And another very important point is that you have to teach yourself. You taught yourself exocad, you taught yourself phaco, you taught yourself all the things you do now, you had to learn on your own. And so similarly, in 5 years from now, 10 years from now, there'll be new things, new technologies, new techniques. You got to keep teaching yourself.
Exactly.
Yeah, so then the neat part is, yeah, anywhere you go, you got like your phone. I got an endless supply of HD videos. I can watch anything.
Yeah. In fact, it was a very rainy day here Sunday, and I watched numerous cataract coach videos. I mean, and I really do. I mean that from the bottom of my heart. That is really a great contribution you've made to our field.
Oh, thank you. It's certainly a passion. Some people, my kids think maybe I'm a little crazy to make a video every day.
That's a
But now
lot of work.
I can't stop. Now that I got 2,100 videos, I can't stop now. Like you, I jump in full passion. We're gonna do it. We're gonna do it right.
Exactly. Yeah, that I mean that and I think that's the way you approach surgery, and that's the way everyone should approach surgery, is do the absolute best you can do for that particular patient that you're
Right.
working on, and the results will be wonderful results, and you'll have a long, prosperous career.
No, for sure. That's actually great, great advice. Give every patient your very best. Give the surgery
Exactly.
you'd want to receive, for sure.
And then if you have a problem, that's one of the things that I did when I noticed a problem, like for example, the egetsural drift that people were having with older cataract surgery from the top, or the unpredictable refractive surgery outcomes, things of that nature. if when you have a problem, really, you know, just sit down and think about it. And don't be afraid to consult other people. And, you know, by doing that, a lot of people have solved a lot of problems. Look at Howard Gimbel and continuous capsulosis.
Right.
I mean, look how that's changed our field. I mean, that, clear cornea, you know, toric intraocular lenses.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, interestingly enough, I had the privilege of launching the toric intraocular lens in China. And then I had the honor of actually introducing modern phaco to Mongolia.
Wow. And
that was a tremendous experience to help people that I will never meet. And that's, I think, one of the things that drives you, is that you're helping people that you'll never meet by helping other surgeons.
Right, for sure.
And I applaud people that dedicate their lives to not only helping people, but helping other people help people.
Right, I can have a much bigger impact. If I can exactly. Show a neat technique to a thousand surgeons and they can use it for tens of thousands of patients, then it's amazing.
Yeah, I actually had a patient, an ophthalmologist sent me a message that during the Katrina hurricane, a patient mm-hmm. had gotten an eye injury, and he used a technique he had learned from me to save the patient's eye. And that was very gratifying, I have to say.
Oh, absolutely. Another neat thing we're doing now is crowdsourcing input. So I had a case maybe a couple weeks ago on Cataract Coach, a surgeon sent in where the capsule, the anterior capsule, behaved very strangely. It was just kind of weird and extra thick and rubbery, and I didn't know exactly what was going on. So I put the video up on Cataract Coach and elicited comments from the viewers. And now you've got dozens, if not hundreds of ophthalmologists saying, oh, I've experienced this, here's what it is. And you can elucidate an answer or a resolution mm-hmm. to some unknown thing instantly.
Exactly.
Really,
technology
amazing.
Is an amazing thing when it works.
right. But yeah, I think it's a really important skill, like for especially our podcast listeners and viewers tend to skew a little on the younger side. Really important to understand that your residency and your fellowship are great, but they're just giving you the basic building blocks. Your learning is going to be on you for the next many decades.
Exactly. And we're counting on those people to continue to advance our profession. Because yeah. if you look, you know, we have made such great strides, but people coming after us, they're going to see further because, as Spencer Thornton used to say, they're standing on the shoulders of giants. Not saying that I'm a giant, but just saying, you know, that the people coming behind us, they right. do get to look back at our experiences and the progress that's been made. And it's going to be amazing, I think, what ophthalmology does in the next 10 years.
What do you think that's going to be? What do you think is coming down the pike here?
So one of the things that we're doing now is we actually have registration so that our toric lenses are much more accurate. And so I'm using the Aptera lens for people that have irregular astigmatism. Right. That's something that we've made a significant amount of progress with. I do think we're going to probably have a laser that will really reduce higher order aberrations in the future. I'd love to see a true accommodative IOL.
Right.
I don't know whether we'll get there or not, but I'm thrilled that people are working on it. I don't know, you know, what the future holds on that. Robotic cataract surgery mm-hmm. may be something that will help us a tremendous amount in trying to catch up. You know, we got so far behind during COVID, and I don't know that our area is ever going to get totally caught up. Everybody is so busy. So robotics may be a great way of helping a lot more people. So it'll be really interesting to see what kind of new pharmaceuticals we have as well. So,
yeah, I think I agree with you there. I think for me, my wish list, if you will, would be, yeah, accommodating IOLs, especially now that I'm presbyopic. definitely robotic cataract surgery. I think I'm working with a company now where I'm amazed at what the robotic cataract surgery does today.
Wow.
It's really just, it's amazing. Now, obviously, this is all just still in development. Nothing's FDA approved, but I think it's coming for sure. Mm-hmm. There's no way of avoiding it. And it'll actually make us far better surgeons, safer surgeons, more efficient surgeons. And maybe we can increase that throughput. Like you say, there's going to be no shortage of work for us as ophthalmologists.
Yeah, the population is aging. People are developing cataracts at a younger age. And people's visual needs are actually increasing. So I don't think we're going to be lacking work, that's for sure.
No, it's a fantastic field. Now, like you were saying earlier, I think we're both thankful every day to be ophthalmologists. I mean, what a blessing it's been.
Oh, for sure. No question about it.
But yeah, as these things come along, yeah, it's, again, important for young people, stick to it. Get involved with these projects. Get involved with consulting. I learned that early on from you, too. Get yourself on the podium. Now that you're back doing all this vacation, now I'm going to start inviting you to all these meetings. I got to get you back on the podium.
What was interesting is after I was on the podium and then I had to drop out to work, I was thinking, you know, people are going to forget who I am, and it's not I'm not going to get any opportunities. And then next thing you know, I there for about a 3-year period of time, I was on the Sawdust Trail. I did, according to people that are supposed to know, they said I did more dinner programs than anybody in ophthalmology over that 3-year period. So that was a lot of fun getting to meet and see people in different areas. And so, I would like to get back on the podium a little bit in the future, but, we'll see what happens.
No, I think you definitely have to. In my 30s, I went absolutely crazy on doing the countless countries, traveling all the time. But you're right.
You know, I remember that. I saw you everywhere, brother.
I know. I saw you in many different countries. But the problem is when I did that, it was at the expense of spending time with my family. And that ended up being a mistake. And then what I did in my 40s was I took like 7 or 8 years of zero meetings and only doing family stuff and traveling with the family. And I'll never forget, my kids are probably 11, 12, 13 years old. I took them to Europe for more than a month in summer break. And I said, you know what? And we still now, 10 years later, still talk about that trip and how much fun it was.
Yeah. Well, you know, you've always heard this thing about quality time is the most important thing for children and grandchildren. But you really can't have quality time without quantity time.
That's true. It's absolutely true. And yeah, so then now when my kids went off to university, then now they're living away from home, I said, you know what? Now as an empty nester, I'm getting back into it. And ophthalmology is still here.
Exactly.
and people don't forget you.
Yeah.
And so you can always take a break from it, prioritize your family. And listen, maybe you like me, become an empty nester. Get back into it. No problem.
Exactly.
Oh, I really welcome you back. You are really a fantastic teacher. I mean, so much of what I do in the operating room, like I said, my lecture on piggyback lenses, I learned that from you, right? Switching to a temporal incision for a scleral tunnel for a big incision, I learned it from you. So it's just a lot of stuff.
It's really interesting how we learn from one another and, you know, sharing things. And I look back and I see what I'm doing now is so, so different from what I did when I first came out of my residency. And I thank so many people for taking the time to teach. I mean, I got to be Spencer Thornton's tag along for quite a few years, and it meant so much to me. And then developing friendships, as I said, with Howard Gimbel and Howard Fine.
Right. All amazing
Charles
people.
Charles Kelman. They really changed my life. not only professionally, but they changed my life personally, because at age 42, I had to have cataract surgery. And so I had a continuous capsulorhexis.
Nice.
I had a small incision, and I have, you know, foldable lenses. Dick McCool did the cataract surgery for me. And I'm so grateful, because I've done more surgery after cataract surgery than before cataract surgery. And so I'm grateful for it personally, as to what it meant to me. And I look back, and I was thinking about this before the podcast, and I was thinking about the lenses that we used to use. And I don't even know if you ever saw it, when people were trying to make the wound smaller and get a lens to go in through a small incision. Did you ever see the winged implant?
No, what's a winged implant? I don't even know.
It actually was made out of acrylic, and it had wings, because it wouldn't roll up. So it actually had a hinge and wings, and you could put it in through a small incision. And of course, you only had a small aperture to see out of, so it never really was real popular. But just think about, we went from 7 millimeter lenses to, and at the same time, a lot of AC lenses.
Right.
And then we go from there to the Mazzocco Taco.
Right.
And the Charles Kelvin's winged lens. And then now that we have these phenomenal acrylic lenses, you know, that go through a small incision. It's really interesting. I will tell you just a quick aside, though, to show you how an individual can have an impact, and to pay attention to your patients, but also be willing to step out. Do you remember when the corneal melting happened with the generic diclofenac?
With the NSAID, yes.
Okay, so you may remember I was the first person to report that, and ended up testifying before the FDA, and just to show you what one person in private practice can do, after I reported it to the ASCRS, Monis Kraft ended up sending out the questionnaire, and we ended up getting a product taken off the market that was really dangerous to people's eyes. Well, there's another story that people may or may not remember, but back with the original acrylic lenses, there was a major glistening problem that occurred.
Right.
And John Hunkler and I went and met with a company that was involved, and they had said, well, we want to use up inventory before we take this off the market. And I said, you know, the Tylenol people, when the Tylenol problem happened, it wasn't their fault.
Right.
But they did the right thing, and they took it all off the market. And now they're number one. I promise you that if you do the right thing and take this off the market now, you'll be number one. But as Teddy Roosevelt said, speak softly and carry a big stick. I said, if you don't do the right thing, I'm going out there to the SCRS meeting, and I'm going to expose this on the platform. And John Hunkler was the president at that time. And he said, I'm going to give him the platform to do it. But I'm just saying that's what one person that's committed to patients and patient care can make a change. And thankfully, by observing our patients and then being willing to share and then being willing to stand up, you know, an individual can make a change. And I'm thankful for having the opportunity to make a few changes.
Yeah, I think we've seen that so many times in ophthalmology, that one person can actually make a huge difference.
No question about it. And you're making that difference now, friend.
Well, we're trying. Now, I got a question. I was just doing some math in my head. You started practice at 27. You were very precocious. What'd you finish high school when you were 12? How'd you get through this so fast?
So, Uday, I actually was the youngest practicing ophthalmologist in the U.S. at that time. And so I was the first male in my family to finish high school. And we were very poor. In fact, if the wolf had come to our front door, he'd had to brought a picnic lunch because we were poor. And so I calculated up that if I finished college in 2 years, I would cost half the money, because at that time you only paid tuition per time, not per course. And so I actually finished college in 2 years. I'd finished high school in 3, and then finished medical school in 3. So I ended up practicing as an ER doctor before I went into ophthalmology, and I finished my ophthalmology residency and opened up here. Believe it or not, I opened here in 1983, and I've done over 70,000 cataracts.
Wow, that's so amazing. But yeah, that's precocious. This is why in ophthalmology, I never try to compete on brains, because I'm not that smart. Most ophthalmologists are like super geniuses. Like, I can't imagine finishing college in 2 years and med school in 3. At high school in 3, it's like, that's amazing. But you know what? Honestly, it shows your passion. When you decide, you are always all in. If you decide you're going to be a powerlifter, you're all in. If you decide you're going to be an ophthalmologist, you're going to get it done, and you're going to crank, and you're just going to pedal to the metal. I love that about you.
Well, thanks. It's given me more than I've ever thought possible. You know, the joy of helping people see and helping other people help people see, that's incredible.
Now, when you started practice, you're 27, 28 years old. Don't patients look at you and say, you look awfully young to do surgery? did you get that a lot?
They don't do that anymore.
No, but I mean, back then, you must have gotten that.
Back then, yeah, people would look at me and say, are you sure you're old enough to be doing this? And you know, that occasionally a person would choose to go elsewhere, but I came to an underserved area. So it was a place where people were needed. And a lot of our folks, by default, I've become, you know, kind of the go-to glaucoma guy. Not that I wanted to do it. It was just so many people were going blind from glaucoma, and they asking them to travel from Middle Georgia to Atlanta was like asking them to go across the United States. They either didn't have the funds or they had fear. And so many people in this area were going blind. And so by default, you know, I ended up taking care of a lot of people with glaucoma and really severe cataracts. And then I realized I had finally arrived. When I was no longer just getting those folks, I was operating on doctors every week. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you go, well, you know, I finally got some credibility. And then, you know, when I developed the temporal approach and the piggyback technique and started getting referrals, you know, I said, well, I'm finally one of the senior respected doctors. And a funny story, a good friend of mine, and I'm sure a friend of yours, Alan Carlson, he had a patient that came in that had an intraocular lens problem. And he said, I'm not too enthusiastic about doing this IOL exchange, but I've got this real close friend in Georgia that just loves doing it.
All right.
I said, gee, thanks, my friend, but it's nice to be, you know, respected by your colleagues and get referrals, you know, by your colleagues and being able to help their patients out. That's been a neat thing as well.
I do something similar now in the LA community. If I have a tough case coming up, I'll actually, especially with my former residents, I'll refer the case to them. And I say, hey, if you want, we'll even do it together. But yeah. I said, you need to do this tough case because you don't have any gray hair. This will add plenty of gray hair. It'll give you more credibility. Once it gets gray in the temples, you're looking pretty good.
And one of the things that you shared on one of the other podcasts is so true. You know, when we're doing those really tough cases, we are taking a lot of stress into our lives. And we may very well be shortening our lives a little bit, you know, trying to help other people. I remember I had a patient during COVID that dropped a chainsaw on his eye.
Oh, my goodness.
And you can imagine what that did. And I operated on him for 3-4 hours. And after I finished, I noticed I had some discomfort in my posterior and found out that staying in that one spot that long, I developed coccidenia. And so I'll have that, you know, from now on. I don't regret helping him. He got 20/40 vision.
Right.
But, you know, there are sacrifices that we make. But then we have these really neat things. I was going to just share this with you.
Sure.
Remember I told you I sat down and I spread charts out everywhere and I was looking at various things. And I was looking at our IOL exchanges. And I did have a minor in math when I went through college. And I came up with a formula for doing IOL exchanges. And then one day I was at ASCRS and I saw Sam Maskett actually put my formula up and say that was his preferred formula for IOL exchanges. And then I was doing live surgery in the Philippines, and the person speaking before me actually put the formula up. And I said, yeah, that's pretty deep. That, you know, that just sitting down with charts spread out and coming up with a formula, it ended up helping people do IOL exchanges. Now, of course, things are so much better, and people like Warren Hill and Jack Holliday, you know, have made such, you know, great contributions to IOL calculations. I just stand in their shadow, you know.
Tell me about the formula. What was the formula for IOL exchange?
To be honest with you, I'd have to show it to you. I don't remember it. but it was a ratio I'd set up you would take the power that you put in, and then you would have the refractive error and what your goal was. And then it was then just a simple ratio. And as you know, it's not an exact one diopter per one diopter.
Yeah.
You know, and as you've said, with your rule of nines.
Yeah.
So what we typically found, it was something like 0.8 or 0.7 when you were doing that. But I actually did it with a ratio. And then you cross multiply and divide, and then you have the ratio, and it actually worked out very well for exchanging lenses when the power was incorrect.
Oh, very neat! Yeah, that's all neat stuff. But it's very gratifying to see your material up on someone else's lecture.
Yeah, why it was neat seeing you do the piggyback thing the other day.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, you know, that's just cool. And I heard one of the podcasts recently when people, one of the speakers said, I'm sorry, you know, there are three signs of getting older. One's losing your memory, and I can't remember the other two. But one of the people I talked to actually brought my name up as one of the original refractive cataract surgeons. And I was honored.
Oh, yeah, Lucio Morato.
Yeah, so I was honored that came up. So.
No, you've had a worldwide impact. I mean, you've done, obviously, you know, you've taught ophthalmology, and I've seen you teach ophthalmology in, I don't know, at least maybe a dozen countries. So you've had an absolute worldwide impact, which is amazing to think that a very precocious, smart kid from a small town in Georgia doing solo stuff changes worldwide ophthalmology.
Well, you know, that's what Howard Fine said. He said, he told me one day, he said, Johnny, that's one of the things I love about our profession, is a Southern redneck poor kid can be friends with a New York Jew. And he and I were close friends. And that has been awesome, to be able to see people and become close friends with people of different parts of the country, different parts of the world, and have that camaraderie, you know, sure. And seeing that we're all interested in the same thing, doing the best for our patients and the best for our family. So that's one of the things I love about our profession, is being able to do that.
Yeah, no, that's super, super important. I think it's, again, we're all blessed to do ophthalmology. And yeah, one person, like if there's someone out there listening and you're just starting off, I promise you, you can have a mega impact in this field. All you need is the hard work, enthusiasm, that passion. That's it. Exactly. You can do it.
Exactly.
And
that dedication, yeah. It reaps great fruit.
No, for sure. And then again, not being afraid to like question the current dogma. If something strikes you, I think that's a really important point. Sometimes we're taught too much to just like go with the flow, don't ask questions. But no, we probably should ask questions. We see something like, well, why is this? And let's figure something out.
You know, Bill Dorn with Alcon just retired. And he told me one time, he said, Johnny, sometimes you are a thorn in my side. But he said, one thing I've learned is to listen to you, because you really are a good observer. And that's one of the keys, is pay attention. And then when you pay attention, don't be afraid to question. I love what you shared there, you know, questioning. And that's how our profession advances, is questioning and then changing some things.
No, for sure. For sure. Absolute pleasure talking to you, Johnny. I, as always, learned so much about you. I'm going to keep up on the weightlifting, but I limit myself now. I don't go above a certain point just to for the safety of my joints here. But
I agree with you, brother.
But I never won a single medal in weightlifting. For me, I do it just mostly for the sanity. It makes me feel better.
I think it's a great thing to do. I think if anything, it does slow down the aging process a little bit.
Well, you know, many studies have shown that for patients after a certain age, resistance training is by far the most important exercise to preserve bone density, muscle mass, metabolic health. It's all about resistance training.
And you never know when you're going to be asked to get in the ring.
I haven't done it yet. Now, are you still you getting in the ring still for wrestling?
Oh, no, not anymore. Not anymore.
Oh, I also want to ask you, before we go, I want to ask you about your funhouse, Johnny G's Funhouse. Tell me about this. People don't know.
Well, we actually at one point had Georgia's largest family fun center. And it was something that I did for the community. And a lot of kids had their first birthday party there. And they had their first job there. But anyway, I sold it right before COVID. And I'm so thankful I did, but I'm really thankful I had it, because a lot of kids have a lot of great memories from it.
Wow. So you're an absolute pillar in your small little community there. You're like the godfather in the community.
Well, that's amazing. This community really supported me, especially when I got robbed, as I shared with you. And I've always felt like I should give back to the community. In fact, you might go online and look. I did a public service announcement for an anti-bullying campaign, and we're helping out with school seminars on bullying and teenage suicide. And I think, you know, everybody really should try to contribute back to their community, and frankly, contribute back to society as a whole.
For sure. For sure. What great ending words. Johnny, again, such a pleasure to have you on my podcast. I'm sure that's going to be a very popular episode. And I'll definitely feature some of those videos you sent me in the next couple of days. So if you're listening to the podcast on the day it's released, be sure to check out cataractcoach.com for those videos, which are going to be amazing. And I want to remind our audience, remember, our podcast is every Sunday, a brand new episode. You can get it on Apple, Amazon, Spotify, Google, YouTube, anywhere you get podcasts. It's all there. And Johnny, thanks again. And I will see my viewers and listeners next time.
Thank you.